This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
A president weakened at home. What does it mean for America abroad? I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Bush is in Latin America, leaving behind scandals, indictments, and a 60% disapproval rating in the latest polls. His opponents at home and abroad may take joy in his chastening, but what do foreign leaders really think about it? When an American president is overdrawn at the bank of public opinion, is the world a safer place? And later on Reporter's Notebook, the mysterious object at the heart of our galaxy. Light goes in, and it never comes out. But is it really a black hole? First, this news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. On today's show, the view from overseas on President Bush's troubles. What kind of foreign business gets done when a president is preoccupied with domestic problems? And later, on Reporter's Notebook, scientists get a new look at something they can't see, the black hole in the center of the Milky Way. But first, this news update. President Bush is in Argentina today for the 34-nation Summit of the Americas. The president's visit inevitably sparked protests, and I'm joined on a line from Mar del Plata, scene of the summit, by Richard Lapper, Latin America editor of the Financial Times. Hello, Richard.
Hi there.
Tell me a bit about today's protests.
Well, I mean, several thousand. I mean, difficult to estimate the exact size, but maybe... I don't know, it's a pretty big march that set off from the railway station in Mar del Plata this morning, led by Maradona, the former Argentine international footballer, who's a bit of a cult idol here, and Evo Morales, the coca growers farmer, who's a big presidential hopeful in Bolivia, and these two figures led this anti-American march to a soccer stadium in Mar del Plata, and where they listened to... Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez promised to bury the free trade of the America area of the America Agreement. So it was kind of quite a lively demonstration. Certain amount of anti-Bush rather than anti-American sentiment expressed. People unhappy about U.S. policy in the Middle East, and particularly unhappy about what they see to be a kind of policy of plunder in Latin America. You know, these were the trade unionists, they were community groups and so on and so forth. Quite a lot of people there, many of them had traveled overnight to get to Mar del Plata.
But you do say it's only several thousand. We're not talking about a tumultuous crowd of 100,000 screaming about Bush's
visit. There were 100,000 people there. I think there may have been tens of thousands, though. It was a pretty big site. It was a pretty long march, but, you know, these things are notoriously difficult to estimate. But it was local people said it was the biggest thing they'd ever seen. That's not too surprising, being Mar del Plata, normally very quiet seaside resort here, but it was a sizable demonstration by Argentine standards, I think we can say.
What was the security situation like? The Argentines do security, as we know.
Well, the Argentines have been, incredibly almost overdid it on the security. It's difficult to overdo the security, isn't it? Because they can't really afford anything to happen here. But it was an incredibly elaborate security arrangement. It's almost impossible to get into the area where any of the presidents are based. You have to go through three separate lines of cordons of security. There are 7,000 Argentine police and troops on the street here. So the chances of anything amiss happening are pretty, I would have thought, quite remote. The Argentines seem to have taken every precaution they possibly could. The whole thing has been very expensive, by the way. Which really leads you to wonder what this is all about, really, and why it's taking place.
Richard, earlier you had mentioned that the protesters marched to a stadium where they listened to a speech by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez.
Yeah.
In a sense, the pre-summit publicity has actually focused almost entirely on the personal relationship between Hugo Chavez and President Bush. President Bush was asked about this earlier today at a press conference.
I will, of course, be polite. That's what the American people expect their president to do, is to be a polite person. And I will, you know, if I run across him, I will do just that.
That was President Bush responding to a question about how he will act when he meets Hugo Chavez. In the streets of Argentina and around Latin America, does this personality clash actually resonate with people?
I think to a certain extent it does. I mean, I think the background to this is quite important to outline here. I mean, you know, Chavez is a president that's having a lot of influence recently on the back of the very steep rise in oil prices, which gives, you know, Venezuela is a very big oil producer. It has a lot of money to spare as a result of the oil price rise. And Chavez has been spending it to buy support amongst some of his neighbors, and particularly weaker countries that have been themselves hard hit by import oil are very happy to get the benefit of cheap oil from Venezuela. And that's benefited lots of countries in the Caribbean, tiny island states in the Caribbean. Cuba's economy has been given a big boost by Venezuelan support, and several countries to the south. You know, Chavez has built very close relations up with the Uruguayans, with Argentina. There are various economic deals, and so this is really building his influence. And I think, you know, Latin Americans, perhaps in general, feel they've got other options than dependence on the United States. You know, which was very much the case in the 90s, of course.
Very quickly, Richard, what should we be looking for to happen at this? Is this just going to be a ceremonial get-together, or is there something major that could happen quickly?
Well, what we're going to see is a bit of discord about the free trade area of the Americas. The free trade area of the Americas is agreed 11 years ago. It's really been going into the sand anyway, I think. I mean, not really going anywhere, partially because of protectionist sentiment in the United States and opposition from farmers and trade unions to further kind of trade opening, in a sense. And this is the bigger South American countries, Argentina and Brazil, are really pressing for access for their agricultural products to the U.S. market.
Richard, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you there. We're just coming to the end of the segment. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Richard Lappers, Latin American editor of the Financial Times. I'll be back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, back with To the Point. In an interview recently, the president of Poland, Aleksander Kwasniewski, said, "The world does not need an America that dominates." But looking at the troubles that have beset the Bush administration, he added, the world needs an America capable of overcoming these problems. There you have the essential dilemma of the unipolar world of this historical moment. During the first term of his presidency, riding a post-September 11th crest of domestic popularity, and with his party in control of both houses of Congress, President Bush set the U.S. on a unilateral path in international relations. And on a wide range of foreign policy issues, most notably Iraq, the administration acted peremptorily. Now, with his administration weakened by scandals and the post-war failures in Iraq, the president and America's position in the world is different. We're talking in this hour about how people outside the U.S. view the administration's troubles and what a weakened administration means to policymakers in other parts of the world. Martin Wagner is the correspondent for German Public Radio in Washington. Hello, Martin.
Hello.
Now, the war in Iraq was far from a popular policy in Germany and in most of Europe, and certainly the German government offered no support. What is the current view at street level and government level in Germany of the Bush administration's troubles?
Let's start with the government level, because we don't really have a government now. We have negotiations about a new government, and so we will see what comes out of the Grand Coalition. But on the street level, I would say there's a lot of feeling, yes, we were right, even in 2003, when you have the indictment against Louis Libby, the former chief of staff of the vice president. And the feeling on the street level is we were right when we said before the war, there is no reason to go to war with Iraq. So I don't know whether it helps anybody, but anyway, this is the feeling.
Schadenfreude is a German word. Is that the word that people feel? Are they taking joy in the president's humbling?
In a way, I would admit that you have these feelings gloating about this, what's going on here, that the president, after he won the elections, and I went back to Germany after the elections last year to talk to people, to give some lectures, and many people said, we can't understand how this president could get re-elected after what he did. And this was already in 2004, and now the feeling is, yes, Schadenfreude, you're right.
Now, you mentioned the fact that there's negotiation going on, but Angela Merkel is going to become the new chancellor. She will be in charge, and she will have some say about German foreign policy. Is there Schadenfreude at the upper levels of government in Germany? Is there a sense that, well, you know, perhaps now we can convince this administration to see things more our way and act in a more cooperative fashion, particularly in policies related to the Middle East, for example?
Maybe we will see with the new government in Germany a different approach. Maybe it will be the British approach that you have to say, yes, we are with you, America. Yes, we are with you, Mr. President, but we have some different ideas. So this might be the different approach we have to see. But Angela Merkel, before the war, was very supportive. She met Vice President Cheney and was much closer politically to the government here, to the administration in Washington, than the Schröder government was. So, yes, we might see a shift.
Martin Wagner is the correspondent for German Public Radio in Washington, talking to us from Washington. Dr. Mark Duckenfield is an assistant professor in international politics at the London School of Economics. He's the author of Business and the Euro and various articles on European and American politics. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
The period, the last, particularly going back to 2002 when the drumbeat for war began to the present, has not been a happy time for much of European governments and their relations with the U.S. Is that changing now?
Well, it still remains a troublesome issue for European governments. 2-3 years ago, they were very concerned about the mainly unilateral American policies, and now they continue to remain concerned about those. However, the governments, like Martin was pointing out, Germany, France, had taken a step back and said, we don't want to be part of this exercise, are now thinking, well, it's a pretty good thing we weren't. Look, it's all going down the tubes.
Well, I've got one last point to make about Iraq, and then we'll broaden this out. Silvio Berlusconi, who was is a keen supporter of the president, this past week on Italian television, said, I quote, "We tried right up to the end to persuade Bush and Blair not to launch a military attack." He's claiming that he repeatedly tried to convince the U.S. not to go in and that there were better ways to remove a dictator. That's a sea change, isn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it's representative of some of the many problems Bush is having in Europe. There's an element of rats leaving a sinking ship here. Berlusconi certainly was quite a trumpeter of George Bush 2 years ago. Now that it's become so much more of a problem and the Italian Secret Service is getting caught up in the whole Niger uranium documents scandal, Berlusconi has a domestic audience that's very much soured on the war, and he needs to protect himself against that, especially with elections coming up in Italy.
It's interesting how the U.S. can actually be a factor. One's relationship to an American president can be a domestic political factor. I mean, clearly Berlusconi is having problems at the moment. He's facing re-election, as you just mentioned, and that for him a good tactic is to suddenly distance himself.
Yes, exactly. It can be advantageous when the American president is popular or the policy initiatives that they've signed up for are successful, but when they're not, all of a sudden you start attracting domestic opposition and it sticks to a government that sticks to the Americans.
Now, we've been talking about Iraq, but Mark Duckenfield, but clearly when the U.S. interacts with other countries interact with the U.S., there's a huge range of issues, some of them related to geopolitics, some of them related to trade. Why don't you tell us some of the areas in which the U.S., when a U.S. administration gets into domestic trouble, it actually affects international relations?
Well, it makes it much more difficult for the U.S. to reach international agreements. The White House will be distracted. The president's not able to push the American bureaucracy to get agreements that he wants that reflect his values, because he has to deal with Libby and Rove and all of these other extraneous issues. And the American president, when his approval ratings are so low, it makes it extremely difficult for him to get any agreements that he comes up with ratified by the U.S. Congress. George Bush might want to promote an agricultural agreement, say, with the Europeans, with the Latin Americans, and yet he knows he needs the support of these Republican senators and representatives from Midwestern farm states, and he's not going to be able to get their support if he's seen as selling out American farmers.
Mark Duckenfield is the assistant professor in international politics at the London School of Economics. Martin Wagner, let me come back to you. This point, for example, about this is an example of the way things work. Agricultural policy reform is a key issue both in the European Union and in the United States. And if there's going to be a true open global trading system, both of these economic superpowers have to change and open their markets. We've just heard how domestically the president is weakened, a humble senator or representative can hold up a whole piece of international legislation because he has something that the president needs and has to ask for.
Right.
Is it a similar system in Germany or in the EU? Let's broaden it out to the EU.
Sure, you have different countries with different interests in Europe, and the Germans are ready to cut into the agricultural subsidies. And as we know from the last summit in Europe, that the French government is not ready to cut into this as deep as the Germans want. And after saying this, I have to say it's not deep enough to change as things are going. So, yes, we have these problems too. We have, on the one hand, we have the European Union with 26 countries, a very complicated organism. And then we have, coming back to Germany, we will have soon a federal government, a grand coalition, but we will have elections in the different states, and then within Germany. So you have all the time the same problem, that one from an agricultural part of Germany, the prime minister will say, but wait a minute, we can't do this now. We have elections. I want to be reelected. So you have the same system, in a way, in Europe too.
Martin Wagner is the correspondent for German Public Radio in Washington. I'd like to bring into the conversation now Mike Moran, who's the executive editor of CFR.org. That's the website of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a former foreign correspondent for the BBC and MSNBC, and he's in New York. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Michael.
Now, listen, give us some specific examples at this moment where policy is, in a sense, being held up because the president is paying attention to, the indictments, and he's got other things on his mind, and there are issues pending before the world.
Well, you can run down a list. Domestically, obviously, we know now from the hurricane to the Scooter Libby to the Supreme Court false start with Harriet Myers. These have caused all sorts of problems. Well, on the president's own, interior base politically. The reality now is that in areas where he once may have had some traction, he finds himself fighting rearguard battles. For instance, in Iraq, Chuck Hagel, a Republican senator, has become something of the voice of those who would like to see some kind of an exit strategy. That pressure had always existed from the minority Democrats, of course, but now this is becoming a more interesting and difficult problem for the president to manage. And this week, a conservative Democrat, Ike Skelton, proposed publicly a very interesting formula for a pullout, which would involve pulling out one American regiment for every three Iraqi regiments that are certified as being able to operate independently. These are kind of spider web You know, it may not be something he has to pay immediate attention to, but this is all building up, and there's a confluence of that plus the eroding public support for the war that's bringing a lot of pressure on him.
But Mike, moving on from Iraq, I mean, there's a range of issues. There's trade issues. There's the situation in Iran.
Detainees with farm subsidy policy. It goes across the board. Trade policy. CAFTA was a very hard-fought, the Central American Free Trade Area was a very hard-fought victory for the president. The idea that he might win another like that is hard to imagine right now. And all of these things, part and parcel of a diminishing ability to spend political capital in the eyes of most analysts.
But from the outside looking, I mean, do policymakers in London and Paris, or for that matter in Beijing, do they sit back and wait until the administration can clearly refocus on these issues? Or do they go ahead and make policy and say, well, you know, sooner or later there'll be a new president?
Well, I'd imagine that even in a situation where the second-term president seems vibrant and moving right along, there's an inevitable sense that things will change soon. It'll be interesting to see the way China and the EU discuss the American context that exists behind both of their all economic and political realities this week, because of course the Chinese leader will be in Europe. These kind of conversations take on a whole new light when the United States doesn't appear to be in an active and somewhat not aggressive but more I'm not really finding the right word here, but basically a forward-leaning mode right now. I don't think that's the way you'd look at the U.S. There's a lot of things that have stretched the ability of the United States to cope, and right now there's a real sense that they're trying hard to manage things already in motion, and there's not a lot of sense that you're going to see enormous new initiatives from this administration anytime soon.
Mike Moran is executive editor of CFR.org. Let me just quickly go to Mark Duckenfield in London. Specifics on North Korea. We saw some movement there recently, but was that movement, the Chinese asserted themselves, a sign of American weakness?
Yes, I think so. The United States has typically been able to show some leadership in a lot of these international issues, but they haven't so recently, and you get that in North Korea, you get it in Iran, and although it's not quite related to Iraq, the Americans' credibility on anything related to nuclear weapons, for instance, is completely shot. The British and the Germans are going to be very wary of what they can get out of an agreement when the United States is pushing a certain point of view about, say, how Iran or North Korea is developing nuclear weapons.
Mark Duckenfield, I'm just going to stop you there. We're coming up to the break. We're talking about the weakened Bush presidency, a weakened American administration. What does that mean in the international order? When we come back after the break, we'll be talking with someone who was on the inside of an administration during troubles. And we're going to be talking about the black hole at the center of our galaxy in today's Reporter's Notebook. Back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. Just before the break, we were talking with Dr. Mark Duckenfield, who's an assistant professor in international politics at the London School of Economics. And we were talking about a specific relations with North Korea and trying to keep an eye on its nuclear ambitions. And, Mark, you were making the point that we have seen some movement, some positive movement on trying to be reengaged with North Korea. But in a sense, this is stuff that could have happened several years ago but didn't. Why?
Well, 3-4 years ago, when the Bush administration first came into office, they pursued a much more chauvinistic foreign policy. They didn't need to have the support of their allies. The Americans could take a leadership and unilateral role, but now they find they're not able to do that, and they're much more are willing to go along with the sort of proposals that the Chinese, for instance, are putting forth to resolve the issue with North Korea.
So in a curious sense, then, the weakness of the administration may have actually improved the international order because it's forced the administration to be more conciliatory in its relations or to allow other nations to take the lead.
Well, exactly. In the case of North Korea, certainly that's the case. And China is such an important country and such a close ally of the North Koreans. They have been able to provide some of that out in East Asia, yes.
We are talking in this segment, listeners, about the effect on the conduct of foreign policy when an administration goes through troubles and is perhaps not as focused on the international side of its time in office as it is on the domestic side. And I'd like to bring into the conversation now somebody who has worked at the highest levels of both national security and diplomacy for the U.S. in an administration that was troubled by scandals. Ambassador Nancy Soderbergh, who was former senior official at the White House during the Clinton administration, a former ambassador to the U.N. during that time. She's also the author of The Superpower Myth, The Use and Misuses of American Might. Ambassador Soderbergh, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, during your time at the UN, and was also, I believe, the time of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and was there a lack of focus in the administration about foreign affairs because there was so much time being spent on the domestic problems?
Actually, people forget, but the investigations started in the first term with the campaign financing scandal and then ultimately escalated to the Monica Lewinsky. So there was a long period of time when various White House officials were under scrutiny, and particularly the president and the first lady. And what happens in those circumstances, and I'm sure what's going on in the White House today, is people hunker down or in personal fetal positions and very surrounding themselves with family and friends, but the work somehow does get done. I think the impact of this particular scandal on the Bush administration will be to reveal that instead of the omniscient and omnipotent administration that they portrayed themselves to be, they're turning out to be bumbling ideologues and therefore have to begin to push back towards more realistic policies in order to get things done.
In the Clinton White House, during your time there, I mean, were you aware that countries – actually, let me phrase this question a little bit better. Do countries wait on the U.S. to get its house in order, to formulate its policies before they formulate their own?
Well, not much in the world happens without the U.S. finally taking a position. Having worked at the U.N. for many years, positions are not firmed up until the United States takes a position. The outside world looks at these scandals as peripheral to what is happening. They do not understand why we're such a Puritan nation. Most of Europe couldn't understand what the Lewinsky scandal was about. You recall President Clinton was at the UN and got the second standing ovation in history, and that was mostly because it was a bunch of guys supporting the president. They do not look at these as serious issues. They want the United States to engage, and I think, frankly, they're all, and you heard from Mark and Martin about the world opinion shifting back towards, well, we were right, and with a sigh of relief that the administration is coming towards more realistic policies.
But so that listeners understand, I mean, I have this. It's like in bureaucracies where the big man in charge hasn't made a decision yet, and there's thousands of people running around saying, "Well, we can't act because we have to know exactly what direction we're going to go in." And does the U.S. decision making actually affect international diplomacy in that?
It absolutely does. But what you'll find in these scandals is, I can speak from being in the Clinton administration, President Clinton actually was more focused on policy making. People would sort of chuckle because instead of having him read the summary of a memo, he'd read back towards the 32nd footnote on page 10 because he was so engaged in policy, he didn't want to go home at night. And in a way, you can hunker down and focus on the decisions and try and shut out the rest of this. So the impact on policymaking tends to be somewhat peripheral to the moment. It's a deep personal scarring on those who are involved. My heart goes out to those who are getting hauled before grand juries, and all of us who've been through that doesn't wish that on anyone. But on the actual policymaking side of it, I have not seen it directly affect a day-to-day decision-making process. What it does in the Bush administration case is make the world question whether or not, you know, all the mistakes of the past were their fault or just part of history. Did we have to go to war in Iraq? Have we done the war in Iraq right? Have we done the war on terrorism? And the disasters of Katrina and the investigations of the White House are beginning to pull that veneer of invincibility off the White House, so that the world and all are kind of looking at it saying, maybe they weren't as smart as we thought they were.
Ambassador Nancy Soderbergh is a former senior official at the White House during the Clinton administration and former ambassador to the UN during that presidency. Mike Moran, executive editor of CFR.org. Is it a dangerous moment when people aren't quite sure which way the U.S. is going? Is there a danger to the world when American presidents become preoccupied with domestic problems?
Well, I think you see, depending on your context, you can view 9/11 that way. On the other hand, you can also turn that question around and look at nations that we in the United States have traditionally looked at as somewhat unreliable and unpredictable, like North Korea, and wonder really whether it makes any difference. I think the broad answer to the question appears to be that in a period like this, as Ambassador Soderbergh was saying, most of the world is loath to take hard and fast positions unless they have been carefully planning and waiting for their moment to take a position that would catch the United States back on its heels.
Are there any nations like that out there at the moment?
Well, you know, the usual suspects, you might call them, Iran, North Korea, who are constantly at loggerheads with the U.S., are always unpredictable, as I say. But I think, interestingly, in many of the trade rounds that go on, in many of the larger questions of relations between China and the United States, between Europe and the United States, things are in flux right now. There's a real sense that the dynamic that's underpinned these relationships for decades is changing dramatically. And I don't think unpredictable, dramatic moves by these large players seem likely right now. And that's certainly what experts, the council and elsewhere, and think tanks in the United States seem to say.
Ambassador Soderbergh, is it possible that a president might actually engage in adventurism abroad in order to deflect headlines, troubled headlines at home?
Well, there certainly has been instances of that in the past.
For example?
The most vivid is probably President Reagan's invasion of Grenada following the death of the Marine in Lebanon. I think history more or less would agree that that was a direct way of trying to deflect behavior on that, and I think there have been times, but I think that's the exception. For the most part, my experience, Democrats and Republicans, that a president really does try and make foreign policy decisions based on how he has viewed the national interest. The weight of that office does tend to drive you in that direction. I think President Bush himself was convinced that this ideological approach to the world after 9/11 was the way to go. I think the hegemons, they're not neocons, they're ideological hegemons who believe the world can be bent to our will because we're the most powerful nation in the world. We're all powerful. That's a myth that has cost America dearly in terms of blood, treasure, and reputation. Who today would build a statue to the Statue of Liberty if you're the students in Tiananmen Square demanding liberty? No one today. And we've lost that moral authority now. The good news is we can get it back by doing the right thing. And you've seen the pendulum swing back. Administration is no longer talking about us versus them and trashing Europe. They're trying to build partnerships in transatlantic. They're now finally willing to negotiate with others on a more realistic policy towards Iran, North Korea, and you're seeing a much more realistic policy. Why Rumsfeld is still in place is a mystery to me. I think he's going to be out by the end of the year, I would hope.
We'll leave the Secretary of Defense for another conversation, Ambassador Nancy Soderbergh, former ambassador to the UN. Dr. Mark Duckenfield is an assistant professor in international politics at the London School of Economics. Ambassador Soderbergh was speaking of moral authority. From your perch in London, does that phrase have real meaning anymore in Europe?
Well, not for the Bush administration. It certainly did after September 11th, which is why the domestic and international constraints on the United States.
Is it actually, Mark, an important aspect in the way others view the United States? For example, there's moral authority. There's it cuts across a wide range of things, but there's also practical authority. I mean, if the president goes off to talk about free trading and how to organize the world economy, I mean, foreign leaders turn around and say, balance your own checkbook, man.
Well, yes. It's both there in the economic realm and in the security realm. And the administration needs to, if it's going to lead, it needs to have the consent of the people that it's trying to lead. And it's very difficult to imagine a European government signing up for any sort of foreign adventure, as you were suggesting earlier. I mean, the Bush administration has zero credibility, and its moral authority is gone in the military realm. In the economic realm, it perhaps has some more. These are very complicated agreements that vast bureaucracies negotiate, but major American deficits and fairly reckless fiscal policies certainly do take their toll, and the Bush administration hasn't exactly shown that it's very interested in free trade. There were the steel tariffs, the farm bill. The Europeans noticed these things.
Well, it's an interesting thing, Mark, but, you know, let's talk about the specific case. Let's talk about Iran.
Right.
Now, there's been diplomacy going on for several years with the European Union providing, through France and Britain, one approach to dealing with Iran's development of its nuclear capability. And I think that it has been a good cop, bad cop routine with the European nation saying we can talk and negotiate, and with the U.S. kind of being off the shoulder a bit, saying, well, look what they did in Iraq, and this is a country that moves forward in quite dramatic ways if you go against their will. But that's not the case anymore, is it?
No, there's certainly been a softening. Iran's making very steady progress in integrating with the WTO. It seems that the French and the Germans, at least, are being able to provide much more of a basis for talking than they had been before, and the Americans are not as recalcitrant as they had been earlier. The Bush administration's ability to really push a unilateralist approach, I think, has been seriously weakened, at least with Iran.
Mark Duckenfield, professor of international politics at the London School of Economics. Mike Moran, executive editor of CFR.org. In the case of Iran, though, while you have the track trying to bring Iran into global trading structures and so on, you know, the nuclear reactor is still there, and there's a lot of prevarication with the new Iranian government, and the U.S. isn't necessarily in a strong position to exert force there, is it?
No, and I think there still remains a very serious debate within the United States policymaking community over the long-term shape of Iranian politics and whether the nuclear gambit is just that, or whether this is a very, very serious threat. The rhetoric of the last week has tended to cause analysts to suggest that this is a more serious threat, and that, as Martin Indyk said in an op-ed this week, that this is something that, at the very least, Israel cannot take for granted if they're going to use terms like wipe Israel off the face of the map, as the Iranian president did. But within the administration, the options are not good. They certainly, it doesn't appear that anybody is talking or leaking any idea that, that a new campaign militarily is in the offing. And on the other hand, the negotiations have really not achieved a great deal. And so I agree. It's just not an interesting or good situation for this administration to proceed on and expect dramatic results.
So it's interesting, Mike Moran, we've heard some examples where the weakened position of the Bush administration may actually have improved certain aspects of international relations. But on the specific question of Iran, which is a nuclear question after all, a weakened America actually creates perhaps greater danger in the world.
Yeah, and there's been a whole debate this week about this mostly turning up in Congress again, and again on the Republican side, ironically, over the decision to suddenly cooperate with India's civilian nuclear program, which, again, in the eyes of many, particularly those who take a very strict view of the NPT, the Proliferation Treaty, tends to suggest the United States is willing to play both sides of the coin. In technical terms, no one who hasn't been a signatory to that treaty under American law is really allowed to be the beneficiary of American civilian nuclear cooperation. And so that has caused another round of recriminations and questioning of the administration's approach to this.
Mike Moran, thanks very much for joining us. Mike Moran is executive editor of CFR.org, the website of the Council on Foreign Relations. I want to thank Ambassador Nancy Soderberg, who is the former American ambassador to the UN under the Clinton administration, Dr. Mark Duckenfield, assistant professor in international politics at the London School of Economics, and Martin Wagner, correspondent for German Public Radio in Washington. Coming up, the latest on the black hole in the center of the Milky Way.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. For a couple of decades, astronomers have known about a dark object at the heart of Earth's galaxy, the Milky Way. What it is and how big it is have been the subject of recent study, and to explain a bit of what scientists have learned about the object, we're joined by Peter Spotts of the Christian Science Monitor. Hello, Peter. You're in Boston, yeah?
I am. How are you, Michael?
I'm fine. Now, what is this thing in the middle of our galaxy? Is it a black hole?
Well, it is thought to be a supermassive black hole, and supermassive means that, you know, obviously this thing is enormous. Often black holes that astronomers often talk about are the remnants of very, very large stars that have basically run out of fuel and basically committed suicide in a large explosion, and this tight core that's left can continue to collapse after the explosion into something so small and dense that nothing can escape its gravitational pull. So this would be a stellar black hole, and the black hole at the center of the galaxy is thought to be, at this point, about 4 million times as massive as the Sun. So it's just huge.
When you say 4 million times as massive, now, let's define our terms. You're talking about its gravitational pull, right?
Right.
Light goes in, it doesn't come out.
Right.
But massive also means in terms of size. Is there actually an enormous black thing that's sort of there?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. This latest research that came out in Nature this week, researchers have really refined their estimate of this thing's size, its physical expanse. But the short answer to your question is no, we can't see it, not directly. Astronomers...
How do they measure it then?
Well, astronomers do it in a couple of ways, actually several ways. One of them has to do with just the effect of this object's gravity on the speed of the orbit around of things around it, stars and other things. Another way is to look at its X-ray signature. Actually, as matter falls into a black hole, it gets very, you know, sort of jumbled up and energetic, and that can emit X-rays. So scientists can actually zero in on this spot in X-rays. But even then, you're seeing the effects of the black hole on the stuff around it. You're not actually seeing the black hole itself. So there basically there are theoretical arguments of what a black hole ought to look like, given what Einstein's told us about matter and gravity. And when astronomers look at various wavelengths at these objects, they see what the theory of black holes says they should see. So they say, okay, this is a high probability then that this is a black hole.
Now, were these measurements made at from one observation station?
No. These latest measurements, we're using radio telescopes across the continent, linked into a one radio telescope, as if they were one radio telescope, and that gets you the marvelous benefit of being able to see things in incredible detail, more so than you'd ever be able to see with any one telescope. So it's a technique called interferometry, and they're able to combine the signals from these very widely separated radio telescopes to get very, very precisely detailed images of objects in both in our galaxy and actually in the rest of the universe.
Well, I think when people think of the Milky Way, they're thinking of images created and perhaps projected on planetarium ceilings or in some of the spacier offerings you might see on the Discovery Channel. And the idea that in the middle of all of that swirl of stars is something unseeable. Is that what holds the galaxy together in that swirling mass?
Well, I'm not sure astronomers would say that it necessarily holds it together, but the more they study these, because they have been finding them in other galaxies as they look, there appears to be some relationship between the mass of the overall mass heft, if you will, of the black hole versus the overall heft of the galaxy. And what that is basically, one of the things that they're concluding is that it may be that these black holes grew up as the galaxy grew up. When they look very far back in time, using things like the Hubble Space Telescope, they see galaxies that are emitting enormous amounts of radiation. They're much more luminous, they're much brighter than many thousands of galaxies collected together. And these apparently are galaxies, very, very young galaxies, with enormous amounts of dust and gas that are feeding supermassive black holes that may well have grown up with the galaxies. They're still trying to test ideas on how these things form in the first place.
Well, what are some of the ideas?
Well, one of them is that you do have this sort of simultaneous growth of the galaxy and the black hole. You know, these black holes might grow. Some people think that they might have started out as a single stellar, star-like black hole that just kept sucking in so much dust and gas and other objects over time, it just fattened up. There are others who think that when galaxies at the early stages of the universe existed, they were much smaller, and then you have galaxies growing because they would combine. You might have smaller-scale black holes in the center of two galaxies combine into one larger one as the galaxies combine into one galaxy, and, this process continues over time.
Well, here's the interesting thing. You talk about fattened up early in that answer. Mm-hmm. And we know that if you fall into a black hole, that's it. You get shredded apart instantly, and the gravity just crushes you. It crushes light and all that stuff. What stops the growth of a black hole?
They're trying to figure that one out too, and the best they can figure out at the moment is that at some point the black hole essentially vacuums up all of the dust and gas and dead stars or even live stars in its vicinity, and it basically just runs out of gas. Now there are literally, and so it stops growing. Now there are some people who think that actually that may not represent the end of the line for the black hole, but it may represent a pause, and that conditions in the rest of the galaxy or even in a cluster of galaxies to which a single galaxy can belong, that conditions there can eventually build up in such a way that the matter, the tenuous gases in these distances get pulled into the galaxy itself and can actually reignite, if you will, or restart the black hole's activity. As this material from way out gradually kind of works its way in.
Now you're beginning to come to images that sort of remind me of the way glaciation happens on the face of the Earth. Sometimes it gets really cold, even when it's warming, and you have glaciers, and then they disappear for whatever reason, and it starts, and it reignites, and it stops, and it reignites. Now, are there theorists who think that this thing in the middle of the Milky Way may begin to tug, and eventually our solar system might be drawn in closer as it begins to reignite?
No, I don't think so, because one of the things that astronomers think they've learned so far is that that a black hole will never, exert, more of a gravitational pull than the object it's made out of. So by that I mean, if, for example, you have a star that becomes a black hole, and let's say the star was 10 times had 10 times the mass of the sun, then the object, even though it's a black hole and you're, a couple of light years away from it, it'll still only exert as much gravity as something 10 times the mass of the sun. But once you get...
Peter,
I'm
going to have to interrupt you. Now we're getting really technical.
Yeah, but
at least I know that I'm not going to get sucked into a black hole anytime in the next 25 billion years. Okay, good. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay.
Peter Spotz with the Christian Science Monitor. The producers of To the Point are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordal, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, and Sharon Rembaum. The managing producer is Karen Radziner. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. The technical director is Mike Newport. And you can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.